Hello and welcome to another episode of Transformational Blueprints, where we try to put a dent in the large number of transformation programs that fail. Hosted by me, Mario Michaels, founder and director of Synaxia Group. On this series, we will bring you unique insights drawn from first-hand experience from some of the most high-profile architecture and transformation leaders across the globe. Topics told in order to share knowledge, experiences, and ideas to inspire, innovate, and give back to the architecture community. So grab a coffee, sit back, and relax. Welcome, everybody. Thanks very much for joining us today. Today, we're going to be talking to Chris Chamberlain about outcome-driven architecture. For those of you that don't know Chris is a seasoned senior IT leader and chief architect with a proven track record in delivering strategic business value through technology and process improvement. Chris excels in people, leadership, and business transformation. The first part of his career was mainly working for consultancies, supporting a wide range of clients across industries, and the latter part being mainly financial service-based organizations, including NatWest, Co-op Bank. His current role is chief architect for Love to Shop, where he's heavily involved with the digital transformation program. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mario. Pleased to be here.
Well, we always sort of, just to give a bit of context into your background, tell us a little bit about, obviously I've just done an introduction there, but tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, it's interesting really. So as a lot of architects, a lot of people started off at uni, did some very computer specific degrees, a lot of them did too. Yeah. And realized early days that actually I didn't want to be a pure computer scientist. I wanted to look at the world around, actually then used all the IT things that were I was lucky, found the opportunity, whichever way you look at it, as my first proper role was actually straight into architecture, which I know is unusual straight from university. So I had a very kind of deep end approach to the world. Progressed through into management consultancy, which then allowed me to look at the broader world and not just technology. You know, what used it, why it was used, what problems did it solve. And then an opportunity came up to then join RBS, as it was, so NatWest Group as it is today, to help turn around a program. Spent a good 7-8 years there doing various different roles. I then moved and joined Co-op Bank, mainly because of kind of family reasons and location. The work in NatWest was really good. The opportunity came to join Co-op Bank. And then two and a half years ago, then joined what was Appreciate Group, which then turned to Love to Shop, which then was acquired by PayPoint about a year ago.
Okay.
And find myself here today talking to you guys.
Fair enough. And we'll go into sort of the acquisition and what that meant from a digital perspective and your role and stuff like that. But really interesting how you were given the opportunity with no experience whatsoever to become an architect, because this is something I've always wondered. Everybody talks about the T-shape architect, and absolutely it's got its merits, right? I completely get that. But what about if there was a completely flipped way of doing things and you got a broad range of experience at the bottom end of your career, you then specialize and then you go broad again, because you'd be able to specialize knowing how everything pulls in from a whole business perspective, data, business, software, cloud, infrastructure, whatever it may be. Whereas at the moment, you know, we see this, oh, I'm a software engineer, I go through the ranks. Actually, I don't want to manage people. Oh, but I really want an influence in terms of the technology. I'm going to go and become a software architect, solution architect, and sometimes enterprise architect, but sometimes they don't make that step because they don't have the right softer skills, which you need to become an architect. So I love the fact that you did it that way. And I'm actually, you know, I've interviewed somebody who led a program like that at EE, where they called them architect technicians, and then you came through the rank as well. And I'm actually interviewing in a couple of weeks a chap who was part of it. So an actual architect that actually came from recruitment into architecture and now works for an amazing business as a solutions architect. So I love that model, but obviously I don't hire and I don't run a business that needs architects. So, but certainly that'd be the the way that I go. But in your opinion, Chris, what do you think makes a great architect in today's world?
It's, for me, it's a mindset and an approach. So any competent person can learn knowledge. That's not the hard bit. You know, every company I've worked for or with has had a different technology stack. So being an expert in a specific thing in a different company doesn't always translate into success for the next company. It's around kind of first principles and understanding what things do and how they work, rather than the very specifics of that application or technology stack. So it's that approach, the logical mindset. It's around communication. And by communication, I mean being able to listen and understand and then play back and ask those questions and translate. If you can't translate between teams, and that's different technology teams, whether that's application and infrastructure and data, whether that's operational teams, so customer contact, the warehouse and processing, if it's then not into kind of front-end business, so marketing and products, if you can't translate, then your effectiveness as an architect isn't as great as it could be. And it, you know, depends on what organization that you're in, right? But the better architects I've found have that ability to communicate at all levels.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And, you know, there's this is why you know, what we talk about today is outcome-driven architecture, right? So there's always a customer, whether that's a consumer, whether that's internal, you know, the marketing team or the sales team, or it's the business as a whole, there's always a customer. So how does architecture lend itself to this model, if that makes sense?
So different people have got different approaches, right, to architecture. You know, there's a number of standards out there, and the fact that there's a number of standards out there tells you there isn't a standard. The approach I take is, if you're not starting at the outcome, if you're not starting at the so what of the question, how can you possibly deliver the best solution in the most cost-effective way that meets the customer demand, whether that's customers that buy the product, whether that's customers or internal users of the system, in whatever guise, how can you possibly deliver the best outcome, the best thing, the best solution, if you don't know why, if they don't know why they're asking for what they're asking? So for me, outcomes is a critical approach and a mindset, and it doesn't come naturally to a lot of people until you really explain what it is and why it's useful and powerful. And most people then, you kind of see the light bulb go off and go, actually, yeah, that's a really good way of thinking about things.
Okay. And I suppose that lends itself into driving value then, doesn't it? Because, you know, we are in a world where, you know, unfortunately there's mass layoffs, and big tech organizations are doing it, and certain other organizations as well. And being on the recruitment side of things and speaking to various different people and on the talent side, a lot of businesses don't really see the value in architecture. Now, I'm not saying there isn't. I'm saying they think engineers can build it, so why can't they architect it, for example? Or that person over there can do that. We don't really need an architect. So outcome-driven architecture really, really... So how do you drive the value of outcome-driven architecture then?
That's a good question. So I'm not diminishing the impact that all of the people have that you've talked through. For me, it's around, again, goes back to the why is this thing being asked for? What is it that is trying to be achieved? And then what's the optimal solution? So what I'm about to say could be heresy to some, but not every solution needs an IT application. Sometimes it just needs people. Sometimes a cost optimal solution is actually just having a person doing a manual process. It could be that. It could be, and some people are going to fall off the chair when they hear me say this, it could be actually an Excel spreadsheet is good enough. You don't need a £100,000 system to do something, when a spreadsheet that you can share between four people will be good enough for now for the cost. And it's, if you didn't take an outcome-based approach, you didn't know what the point of that was, then you could very easily go down a solution path of going, well, this is the solution, so that's what we're going to build, without really understanding the why you're building that solution.
Yeah.
And that's the value that architects can bring, is to critically challenge and understand the end-to-end system and solution and outcome to then propose an optimal solution or solutions mm-hmm. to that problem.
Right. Okay. That makes complete sense. And give us an example of where you've, I know you've just given the spreadsheet example, but where you've actually delivered an outcome-based architecture, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's something that I endeavour to do in all places that I go to. I guess a recent-ish example was for one of the banks I was talking about, where there was a problem with processing applications, so customer applications for products, and it was paper-based. And they came into the store, filled in 50-odd pages of text, that then got scanned in. It then got faxed over to an offshore site, which then got printed, which then someone had to walk upstairs to get the print out, to then walk downstairs to then type into another system. Unsurprisingly, there were lots of errors there. So it's kind of like taking a step back to say, well, what's the outcome that we want from here? It's like, well, what the outcome is that we need that information to be emailed rather than faxed. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's not emailed or faxed, is it? Why are you even writing the information down on paper in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where the forms are. Okay, but what's the outcome that you want to get to? Well, the outcome is we need all that data in the system. Right, okay. So let's skip all of that nonsense in the middle and get a form on a laptop in front of the customer to enter there and then. So it goes straight into the system and, you know, did some automation and other stuff in the back end, so we didn't have to fundamentally change the system.
Mm-hmm.
But to ask the critical, what's the outcome for that versus how do we make a rubbish process go quicker, fundamentally changes the solution and your options.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And what impact did that have on the wider business then? Was it a time saving, cost saving?
Well, so it was an improvement in accuracy, so customer complaints reduced, and it was a reduction in effort as well. So it was close to 50 FTE were mm-hmm. basics of the scale of what was happening were involved, although it wasn't obvious at the time that it was that amount of effort, but 50 mm-hmm. FTE were basically involved in copying the information from a bit of paper into a system.
Jeez.
Adding that form almost overnight changed that, and then, you know, released them to do more interesting things.
Brilliant. Okay, great example there. Thank you. So tell us a bit about your architecture leadership career then. Describe it to us.
So again, in at the deep end at RBS, so I was asked to, so from consultant to leading a team was an interesting people leadership role and move. For me, leadership is not just around people management. It's around leading the vision, leading the approach to stuff. And from relatively early days in my career, I was given the opportunity to lead the pieces of work that I was doing, that mm-hmm. you had the ownership and accountability. And through that, you kind of found opportunities to step out of my comfort zone, to do things I hadn't done before, to do bigger things that were a little bit scary at the time, to then grow and develop and keep progressing. So through that, I eventually became chief architect at Love to Shop. So, you know, incremental steps at each stage to gain that exposure and that experience. And, you know, that is interacting with execs, C-level,
mm-hmm.
direct to C-level, interacting with wider areas of the business that, you know, might not have had experience of before, to have that broader knowledge mm-hmm. and the confidence of knowing who to talk to, how to talk to them, how to present things that align to how they can understand things to get the decisions that then best meet the needs of the customers and the organization.
And that's effectively why you're such a big advocate for business architecture, right? If we look at your career, yes, as you've quite rightly said, it's not very technical. You understand technology, but you understand what it does and but you're not, you've never been a coder, or you've never been a technical or a solutions driven architect from a technology perspective. It's always been business wide, and that's why. So what's the makeup and the functionality of a business architecture function, I suppose?
Yeah, it's people that are inquisitive. It's people that don't accept the first answer as the right answer. It's people that can step back from that detail and understand the bigger picture. So an analogy is looking at jigsaw pieces. So you can look at jigsaw pieces and you can be an expert in that particular jigsaw piece. But how can you possibly create the jigsaw if you don't know what the box looks like?
Okay.
And that's where business architecture comes into play, is that it looks at the jigsaw box, but also understands the pieces that are there and the pieces that are missing, and can start to draw in those missing pieces.
And why is that so important then?
Because if you're only looking at a very small slice of the problem, you don't know what the extent of it is. So again, an old analogy that I'm probably paraphrasing and misquoting here, but you get four people in a darkened room and there's something in there, and one starts to feel something. Oh, it's all rough and tall and straight. Oh, it must be a tree. And then the other one feels something, it's all curvy and a bit soft. Oh, it must be a snake. And then someone feels something that's a bit barrel-shaped. Oh, you know, it must be, you know, a huge animal or something. And, you know, they turn the lights on and it isn't a tree, it isn't a snake, it's actually an elephant. But if you haven't got that picture, you can have a very different perspective of what the problem is and the solution. And you will not get, unless you're very lucky, the optimal solution available if you don't see the end-to-end.
So where does the line draw then? Because you've got, we all know what the sort of four areas of architecture are, but where does the line draw between business and, let's say, oh, here's a challenge the business has got, a piece of technology is the answer. Where do you then pass that on to a solutions architect who's from a technology background without treading on each other's toes and, you know, duplication of efforts, which are time waster?
Yeah, I think it's there's areas of grey, right? Let's be honest, in the real world, there'll be some accountabilities that'll be drawn up, there'll be grey areas. For that in particular, I then use capabilities. So again, it's not everybody uses capabilities, not everyone talks about capabilities, but they link into outcomes. Mm-hmm. So if you know what the outcome is, you can then define that and distill it into capabilities. And then you can understand, well, is that a capability? So something that somebody has to do, or something that something has to do. Is that a human capability, or is it a technical capability? You've got choices and options. And at that point, you can then use that kind of capability view as almost a universal language, regardless of who you're talking to, so that the solution architect, the engineering team, should be able to understand you need a capability to do this. The business side, non-technical people, should also still be able to understand a capability to do this. Now, how it gets delivered, the business shouldn't really worry about, as long as it is that capability that meets that outcome.
Okay. So then where does enterprise architect come into that? Because enterprise, there's a lot of gray area between enterprise and business, because enterprise looks at the business as a whole, right?
It does. And it's around specialisms and accountabilities and individual organizations. So I don't believe I've met any enterprise architect that doesn't understand elements of business architecture.
Yep.
Whereas business architects might come from a different background and might not be as up to speed or as in detail on the technology side. But it's that kind of a grey area, if you like, and progression and in expertise and what you're interested in. So I wouldn't necessarily say there are hard and fast boundaries. It depends. But, you know, those enterprise architects tend to have a broader view across and down, coming up to that kind of T-shaped type model, than business architects that tend to be horizontal, or when they do go down, it's more on the process and operations of things rather than the technology that supports and delivers those processes.
Fine. Right. Okay. I'm with you. So what type of background, and you've built architecture teams, not just technology, but also business architect teams. And, you know, it could be a great route for somebody who's non-technical to be able to build a career in business architecture. What type of background do you think suits a future star in business architecture?
Pretty much any, to be honest. It's, for me, mindset and approach. So as long as you've got the right mindset and the right approach, you can teach most people most things. And again, it comes back to what I was saying earlier around the inquisitive nature, not accepting the first answer as the answer. And then that openness to learn new and different things. The content for me is almost irrelevant up to that point. You know, it depends where they are in their career stage. Yeah, you can come in as contact center expert, operational expert, and then reasonably quickly move into the business architecture world. And in most cases, in some organizations, certainly the bigger ones, there's operational leads or senior people in operations are kind of doing some business architecture anyway. They just don't realize it or they don't call it that. I've seen a few project managers that have moved into it as well. Again, as much out of interest and experience than anything else. And they've realized actually they like drawing pretty pictures and talking about the solution rather than worrying about spreadsheets and project plans. And they've moved into that because that's, you know, depends on your point of view. I think that's more interesting than running a project plan. Other people have created project plans, so I'm not knocking that. But it's you know, what you're interested in, what gets you out of bed in the morning, what makes you want to go to work and really do something different. And business architecture is a good route for that in the right organization to be able to influence the organization in pretty much all different levels.
And it's a really good area or potential area to increase diversity in architecture, because the statistics are horrible. You know, I think I read an article a couple of weeks ago by Women in Architecture and the IASA. 10% of enterprise architect roles are represented by females. And by the way, the caveat is obviously there's a lot more to diversity and inclusion than just gender, but this is just an example. 10% of enterprise architect roles are carried out by females. 6.2% of software architect roles are carried out by females. 18.8% of data architect roles are carried out by females. But funny enough, business architecture, 28.5%, which is above the average of gender diversity in technology as a whole. So, you know, this could be an area whereby, you know, we are developing and progressing architects who are not technical, because, you know, there's a big old journey to go on right down to primary education to for us to see that whole, you know, gender increase in female increase in STEM and then into software, into technology and so on and so forth. So we're talking 2-3 decades away from actually achieving what we want to achieve. But here and now, for us to be able to make a significant change, business architecture could be the answer. So I suppose, you know, your background, yes, you did computer science, but you didn't want, you quite rightfully, or you didn't want to go down that route. What would you advise somebody who comes from a non-technical background, who got into a business like you did as a, let's call them a junior or a technician, architect technician? Yeah. What advice would you give that person at that stage to say, right, if you're going to be a great architect, focus on these areas or do this?
Yeah, for me, it's around creating opportunities. So understand the path that you want to go on. So you might not know every single step on that journey. But you should know roughly the direction that you want to be heading in. If not, that's an entirely different challenge to overcome, right?
Agile career progression.
Yeah, and
just coin it.
It works for some people, not others, right? And yeah. And I've known people that have had a laser focus on what they wanted to do and mapped out every step for 10 years to get to that point, and that's brilliant and that works for them. I've known people that are the exact opposite and have just gone from job to job, and you know, some have ended up in good jobs and some that they like mm-hmm. and enjoy, and some have ended up in or still in jobs that they don't really want to do or like. And for me, it's around what's that direction of travel. Once you understand that, then you can start to look for or create opportunities to fill the gaps in order to make those steps and progress. It's around, if you're in a role in a company and it's not quite the role that you want, and you could see a potential in that company for the role, it's around understanding who can help you or who will put you in those roles and positions, and yeah. and working with them to understand what is it that they want, what is it that you can do, what's the gap between what you can do and what they want, and how you can fill that. It's around having a particular business architecture. It is around knowing and talking to your peers across the organization and people above you, because typically you interact with one or two levels above you as an architect, as a business architect. Yeah. But if they don't see the value, if they don't see the point in why are they talking to you, then they probably won't. So you've got to have a good reason, a good content of why you're going to speak to them. Yeah. And it may be opening, and different things will work for different people, right? Mm-hmm. One approach is to, and most good senior leaders will take this on board and do this. You go to them and be open and honest and say, look, you know, I want to become a business architect. I want to become an enterprise architect. I want to become a whatever it is. I think you're a good person to talk to understand a bit more around it. I'd like to understand more about your world, your role. What are the problems that you have that I can maybe help solve? Now, an even better approach than that is already to do some research and approach them and say, oh, I've noticed X, Y, and Z. I think that's a problem because of these reasons.
Yep.
Here's something that I've been thinking about. Would it work for you? Now, okay. That most senior leaders, most good senior leaders, will take that on board and go, oh, actually, yeah, that's a good point. Let's see what we can do. Some will go, it's not quite right. This is the actual problem. At which point you then go, okay, well, let me come back to with a different solution. It's stepping out of your box, really. Mm-hmm. It's stepping out of those boundaries. Yeah, different companies will treat this differently. Different managers and leaders will treat this differently. The good ones will let you talk to whoever you need to talk to pretty much about whatever without seeking permission or having to go through them and be the filter. I don't sign up to that approach.
Yeah.
And I've stepped out of that approach in a few different roles before, certainly my early career, and had mixed results, should we say. Mm-hmm. But again, you need to make that decision for you of, is that the right environment, the right company, the right culture for you to achieve what you want to achieve? If it isn't, change something. And that's either change your role, change the company, or do something different.
Have a conversation to make that role better from the expectations of from a perspective of your expectations and what you're trying to get out of it effectively. So that might just be a small change rather than, you know, upsetting the apple cart and you know, throwing the baby out the bathwater and leaving roles and et cetera, et cetera. It could just be a friendly conversation with your manager or their manager and just like, this is where I want to go to. This is what I need. Is it achievable here? How do I get it? Et cetera, et cetera. Makes absolute sense. Now, we've spoken about sort of gender diversity, and I know diversity and inclusion is a massive thing on your agenda and something you're really, really passionate about in various different roles. I know when we sort of worked together at the Co-op Bank, you know, it was one of the key criteria for you even back then. So we've got a big problem in not just technology, but specifically architecture. You know, everybody I'm speaking to, well, we've gone through the things there, but how do we change it? How do we make for a more diverse, in fact, why do we need a more diverse architecture community or why do we need a more diverse architecture world?
It's a good question. To challenge the norm, to bring in different thoughts and opinions, to different perspectives, to kind of break the mold, if you like. So I can't remember the specific study, however, where there are diverse teams, it's not just architecture, but where there was true diversity, not just gender, but in all the different aspects of it. There's huge differences in profitability and productivity for those organizations. So at the very least, you know, the bottom line of the P&L, diversity is proven to be beneficial. But also from a workplace, if you don't have that diversity, you can very easily believe your own hype. You can very easily believe your own thoughts and not find the best outcomes, the best solutions, and go down that, you know, tried and trusted process and way of doing things without others coming in and, you know, breaking the mold and challenging things and disrupting things.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, why do I think we haven't got diversity in architecture? I think there's two reasons for this. One is the recruitment process. And I may be generalizing at this point, but recruiting managers need to be brave and take a risk sometimes and be conscious and aware of who they are and how they react to people. And not just recruit people that look and feel, you know, the unconscious biased side of stuff, that look and feel like you, that talk like you, that act and respond exactly how you would act and respond. That's a dangerous path. And I think that's why the architecture world, certainly in the UK, is dominated by white, middle-class, middle-aged males, which I'm one of. And yeah. I fully acknowledge
the irony that we're on this talking about it.
I know and that's why, you know, I look around my team at the moment, and on the architecture side, we're that stereotypical group, right? And it's how do we make those recruitment decisions differently, and how do we attract different people to apply? Which then comes on to the second problem, is perception. So there's a perception, a candidate perception of what an architect is or isn't. There's a candidate perception of whether they can be an architect or not be an architect. You know, and part of it.
And want to be an architect, by the way, because, well, you know, if you're surrounded by, you know, as you've said, you know, white middle-aged men, why would anybody want to, you know, want to work in that environment if they're not comfortable in that environment, kind of thing? So yeah, so there's a need and a want and aspirational thing as well.
Absolutely. And I try and set the culture and tone of my team to be open, you know, diverse, not regimented, but hold people to account. So I hate micromanaging. I hate to be micromanaged, and that's not what I want to do. It's not how I work. So it's that diversity of culture. It's the flexibility of working patterns as well, not to be rigid 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, to come back to outcome focused. So as long as my team are producing what they need to produce to the quality they need to produce it and on time, I don't mind when and where they work, as long as they're, you know, being sensible about it.
Yeah,
I've got 2 relatively young kids at home, and family life is important to me.
Yeah,
and you know, sometimes you just have to go and be somewhere else unplanned at short notice that might clash with a meeting or you know, being in the office.
Yeah,
you know what, my priority is my family.
Yeah,
and I very, very rarely will I choose the work side of stuff over my family. And I encourage my team to do the same as well.
Yeah.
and understand what my core values are, and it's important to have that flexibility. Coming into other architecture teams and technology teams, I've seen a very rigid approach to it, that if you're not sat in your chair 9 to 5, how could you possibly be working?
Yeah.
If you don't turn up to that meeting, you know, well, that's really bad because you need to be seen. Well, then shame on those leaders.
Yeah.
To put it bluntly, shame on those leaders.
It's outcome driven, isn't it? Just like architecture should be outcome driven, social management be outcome, or leadership be outcome driven. So if you were to give any advice, because you've been through the journey, and I appreciate, as you said, you know, your current team isn't as diverse as you'd like it to be. What three things would you implement when you are hiring or when you are building a team to create a more diverse and inclusive team?
So what I have done, I'm working with our HR team to gender neutralize the role profiles and adverts. That's a big learning point for me in the last few years. My language that I use unconsciously is very male orientated. And there's tools out there to help soften and change that as well, which is important. It's then around when I do recruit an interview, I have a broad range of people interviewing with me. So it's not just me. I split it into different sections and invite other people from the organization to help interview. I don't share CVs ahead of those interviews, which I know shocks some people. And even internally, people ask me, can I have the CV? No, you can't. You're going to see the person, you're going to ask the questions, and you're going to judge them on their answers. You're not seeing their CV in the background. You don't need it. That's for me, not for you. And then the third thing, is there a third thing? I'll be honest, I'm struggling for a third thing.
There's loads of, there's loads of little things that that business can do, but ultimately, you know, so I've recently engaged with a client and they've got a big drive and they said, you know, we want a 50-50 shortlist and so on and so forth. And, you know, I had to walk away from it because I completely disagree with that approach whereby you're forcing external partners to provide a diverse shortlist based on their background and their, you know, their profile. It should be based on experience. Now, what you can do is change the role and change what you expect to get out of that role and then work backwards to go and find that person. So in this instance, you know, with another business, they wanted a solution architect and, you know, they came into the meeting, we need this, 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 and this, okay? When you ask for why, what are they going to be doing? What's the outcome of the role? In 12 months, what does good look like? Where do you high five them and so on? All the cheesy questions. Well, okay, well, so they don't really need banking experience, do they? They need consumer experience rather than banking. Okay, well, that opens up retail, that opens up sometimes FMCG. That, and straight away, we've opened up a whole new talent pool. Well, great. Now, what else? And you end up changing the type of person you're looking for. And then that leads into your 50-50 shortlist, diverse shortlist, not driving it from we need, you know, three females, three males on them. That's not the way to do it. So it's, but there's loads of little things that businesses are really getting right. And there's loads of things that they're not. But, you know, one thing that always comes out is definitely role models. You know, people want to see, I know we said don't hire people that are like you, unconsciously you do it. But what people want to do when they're joining businesses is see, right, where are my aspirations to that person, that, you know, that female chief architect is who I want to be, or that female CIO is who I want to be, or that, you know, whatever it may be, how do I get there, you know, and start putting in mentor schemes and stuff like that. So that works great. Oh, we're going to move on to our quick fire questions, Chris. So thanks for your input on that. So first one, what do you expect in 2024 will be an absolute game changer from a technology perspective?
So it's, I don't want to jump on the bandwagon of AI at this point. But I will, but from a different perspective. So okay. I think large language models, so like ChatGPT, for example, which is probably the best known, I think people are going to be using it in a very different way in the next 12 months. I've already seen from recruiting people using ChatGPT to help produce presentations. I've started to use it. My team has started to use it around analyzing requirements and other stuff. I think using that in a different way, I think, is going to be one of the biggest changes in the next 12 months. Depends on when and where legislation comes into place and the security implications around that. But I generally see that as the biggest thing in the next 12 months.
Okay, fine. Makes sense. What advice would you give a newly appointed chief architect, whether that's a promotion into a chief architect role or into a new moving from one business to another into a chief architect role?
couple of things. One is draw a big picture of the environment, of the key systems, and align it then to business functions. So you've got a view of the company. The second one is go and meet, if you haven't already, the senior leaders in the organization and start to understand what their problems are and where they're going. So if you don't understand the strategy, if you don't understand the problems, you will not be successful as a chief architect. So those two things.
Okay. Any advice you wish you received early on in your career?
Yeah, execs are people. Go and talk to them. Yeah. I was absolutely scared stiff to talk to anyone anywhere close to having a C title. Mm-hmm. And over time and experience, I realised actually they're just normal people. You just go and talk to them.
Yeah, fair enough. What's the hardest interview question you've ever had?
The ones I didn't prepare for or unexpected. So there was a graduate role that I went for actually for a investment company in London. I won't name them. It was for an IT graduate position. And the second question I got asked was, if we loan money to a country, how do you assess their ability to pay back?
Okay.
I was like,
I've got nothing to do with IT.
What has that got to do with the and this is the inexperience of me. I tried to answer it rather than challenging the question in the first place. And if I got asked that question today, I would absolutely challenge the person asking me, why on earth are you asking that question for this role?
Fair enough. Cool. What's the biggest change you expect to see in the market over the next 5 years from a talent perspective?
I think this is a tough one. I think demand over flexible working and how and when people work. I think we, in COVID, obviously, nearly everybody worked remote. There's now a move back into the office, but I think that's kind of almost going to Constantina back out into questioning, challenging working patterns. That's not to say people shouldn't work in the office, because I truly think they should for different reasons, but to have a very rigid 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, which I know not many do these days, I think that demand for flexible working, flexible times as well, not just 9 to 5 and location dependent,
basically, or what works around you.
I think the demands for talented candidates, that organizations need to be more flexible, otherwise they're not going to attract or keep that talent.
Brilliant. Okay, thanks for that. Well, sadly, Chris, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for a brilliant podcast episode. It's been really interesting and great to chat to you more in detail around sort of outcome-driven architecture. Thanks again for an excellent podcast episode and giving us your time today.
You're welcome, Aaron. Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Sadly, we're at the end of another Transformational Blueprints episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and there were plenty of golden nuggets for you to take away. If you're a fan of the show, please do remember to share, like and leave reviews so that more people from our industry get to hear and benefit from these too. Please also follow Synactia Group on LinkedIn to keep up to date with new episodes. Links in the show notes. Join us next time for another episode packed with tips and advice from senior leaders in the technology world.